You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of September 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, Bulgaria, one of the poorest countries in the EU, decides the euro isn't for them. What does that mean for Europe's beleaguered single currency? And 5 months after a deadly crash in Beijing, shockwaves are still being felt in China's political class, costing one of Hu Jintao's closest aides his job. We'll have analysis with Paul French coming up.
We have to be very, very careful that the Ministry of Propaganda and the news people there and the Communist Party are not playing us in the sense of giving us selected pieces of information that we can't then externally and independently verify.
And lobsters are getting a rebrand in Maine. We'll be giving them a bit of a makeover ourselves. And then we head to the World Urban Forum in Naples, where we hear from leading experts on city life.
I've been mostly interested in housing for the last few decades, where I've been doing research, housing in developing countries. One of the most significant things about China is there are no shantytowns.
And we'll also be talking to our editor, Andrew Tuck, who's also at the forum. All that, plus we'll have a check-in on the Venice Film Festival right here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. And welcome to Studio One, where it's a rather muggy day in London. It feels like it's going to pour any moment. I'm not sure if that's going to be in the headlines, though, with Jonathan Wheatley. We'll find out right now.
The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said he was deeply concerned about Iran's nuclear program, saying it will make the Middle East much more unstable.
Mr. Speaker, we remain deeply concerned about Iran's nuclear program. A nuclear-armed Iran would result in still greater instability in the Middle East and increases the risk of a nuclear arms race. Iran must negotiate seriously on the nuclear issue to give the international community confidence that it is not developing nuclear weapons.
The president of the Red Cross, Peter Moore, is looking at ways of expanding humanitarian operations in Syria as he held talks with President Assad. The Red Cross spokesman, Hicham Hassan, explained what was discussed at that meeting.
The meeting mainly touched on issues related to the protection of the civilian population during the conduct of hostilities, issues like the necessity of having immediate access to healthcare services, to food and to other basic necessities that have increased in the past few days and weeks due to the continuing fighting.
Meanwhile, the German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle, at an international conference on Syria in Berlin, has said today that Germany does not rule out accepting Syrian refugees for medical treatment and assistance. Democrats are preparing to launch their case for President Barack Obama's re-election at their national convention today at the Time Warner Cable Arena in Charlotte, North Carolina. Police teams kept a lookout for rowdy protesters and possible threats to the convention. Engelmeister, a vendor selling commemorative Obama buttons, said he was hoping to earn some money during the three-day gathering.
I'm here today to support Barack Obama and to sell some buttons and, make a living as people are wont to do.
Indonesian and Australian senior ministers have continued talks on defence issues in Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, including search and rescue operations for boat refugees seeking asylum. The Australian Defence Minister, Stephen Smith, said that the two countries had a very good relationship.
We've just come from a session dealing exclusively with search and rescue matters, and then tomorrow, Pak Penomo and I will sign the defence cooperation agreement between Australia and Indonesia. Make some defence announcements, and we'll also deal together with Justice Minister Clare, and wearing his defence materiel cap, and his counterpart, defence ability and defence materiel issues.
Here in London, a young child who has managed to survive leukemia wanted to congratulate Prince Harry for keeping his clothes on when he knew he would meet him at the charity Well Child's award ceremony. Six-year-old Alex Logan knew exactly what his first words would be to the royal.
Who are you going to meet tonight at the award?
Prince Harry.
And what are you going to say to Prince Harry?
Dad, you got the clothes on, Harry.
Because what did Harry was, there were some photographs of Harry being a bit of a Rudy Nudy, wasn't there?
Yeah. He was doing being naked.
So what is it you're going to say to him?
Dad, you got your clothes on, Harry.
I am too. When Alex finally met Harry, the prince wagged his finger at him and warned him not to mention the incident in Las Vegas. The 27-year-old prince made news around the world when the pictures of him naked with a young woman in his hotel suite were printed in newspapers and on websites. And finally, a man has been arrested in Lagos International Airport in Nigeria after he was caught trying to bring in a chicken with unusual stuffing, £100,000 worth of cocaine. Vincent Chegini Chiwewa flew in from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and said he hoped to start a business with the drug money. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. It is just 1:05, almost 1:06 if you're listening in Singapore, 20:06 in Tallinn and 13:06 in Washington. We're back right after this.
London kala Monocle 24 desu.
Lontosta käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
London bo, as a Monocle 24.
Londodan, burası Monocle 24.
Londest, siinä on Monocle 24.
London kala, London yori. Monocle 24.
And you are back listening to Midori House here in London. Well, the euro could do with a vote of confidence. It's not going to get one anytime soon, though. Instead, Europe's beleaguered single currency has suffered yet another blow. Bulgaria, one of the poorest countries in the EU, has decided that the euro isn't for them at all. Sofia had been planning to join next year, but its finance minister today told the Wall Street Journal that he didn't see any benefits in joining the currency, only costs. Well, for more, I'm joined now on the line from Sofia by Dimitar Bachev, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council for Foreign Relations. Hello, Mr. Bachev.
Hello.
Hello. What is the mood based on this news? How is it playing out? I mean, and given the fact that, of course, it broke in the Wall Street Journal.
It's too early to tell, but essentially, I think what explains the move right now, the timing of it, is the start of the new political season, which will obviously peak with the general elections next summer. What the finance minister is actually saying is that it's probably time to relax fiscal discipline a little bit and to start spending with a view of getting re-elected, which will be the first time around when the government is actually facing the prospect of staying in power since 1989, actually. And that's why the straitjacket of the Maastricht criteria you need to comply with in order to get into the antechamber of the euro. That's why probably there'll be a bit of a U-turn in the offing.
Mm. I guess most major bulletins have either they're on air right now in Bulgaria, or they'll be going on in a couple of hours on television. Does this qualify as lead story news in Bulgaria this evening?
I don't think so, because basically it's yesterday's news. It's clear since probably 2010 that Bulgaria's prospects of joining the single currency very thin, to say the least. To give you some background, Bulgaria is basically part of the single currency of the euro because its national unit is pegged to the euro. So essentially we get all the obligations associated with the euro membership without the benefits, as low interest rates, facilitating cross-border trade for businesses. And the government tried to make headway on Eurozone membership. Now, in 2010, Greece emerged as a problem. The euro crisis started, and the prospects of enlarging the Eurozone abated. And it's not that everybody's expecting Bulgaria to join. It's obviously a long-term project. It's in the interest of Bulgaria, if the euro survives, to be part of it, because it's already part of it. But there's no political momentum towards Bulgaria making any step forward. Anyhow, nobody's expecting Bulgaria to be there. So I think it's essentially linked to domestic politics and the electoral cycle.
Mm. I mean, and part of the electoral cycle, I mean, could one argue that also Bulgaria, from an economic perspective, has other things to get on with? And obviously, we're talking on one side about just, the costs that would come with, adopting a single currency, but it just has other matters to get in order before that.
I don't think the costs are as high because we've paid the costs over an extended period of time. Bulgaria doesn't have any monetary policy to speak of. So So there'll be no sacrifices. There are definite benefits of joining the single currency. Again, with the proviso if it stays around. But definitely the public policy agenda, what the population at large cares about, is very much distant from all those issues. Although, having said that, at the end of the day, the crisis in the Eurozone, which is the biggest by far trading and investment partner for Bulgaria, has major implications, major fallout on the economic situation here, and obviously the political prospects.
Dimitar Batchev, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for that. I'm now joined in studio here in London by Vasilis Monastriotis. He's the Director of LSE's Research Unit on Southeast Europe. Good evening. Welcome.
Hi.
When you listened to the word from Sofia, does that chime with what the research unit is also seeing at LSE?
Yes, I think I also tend to agree with what Dr. Batchev said just before. It seems to me this is much more a domestic politics issue and to some extent also an attempt to speak to Germany predominantly or speak to Brussels to say that we may relax our fiscal policy in the next year when it's an election year, but you know, don't be afraid, we're still sticking with the rules and we are in support of fiscal austerity as defined by the core of the Eurozone, including Germany.
How do you think this is being received, certainly in the rest of the patch that you look after in Southeast Europe? How do you think other capitals are viewing this this evening?
Yes, I think, of course, we had the similar talk from other new member states, so countries that joined in 2004, Lithuania, Latvia, also Poland, also have indicated that they're not keen, you know, they're not in a rush to join, and who would be, of course. Part of the story is that the environment is much more uncertain now, but also that they want to see what is the political solution that's going to be taken forward in the Eurozone before they decide to join. But I think, as with Bulgaria, this will not be big news in the rest of Southeast Europe. There's other worries and other problems in the region by far, and nobody really expect Bulgaria to be entering the Eurozone immediately, especially given the time of the crisis. The time originally planned was 2014-2015. Maybe it will take until 2017, but this doesn't really matter.
Should we just jump down to Athens for a moment? And you know, with you know, political season, and you know, as we sort of course, move into the last quarter of the year, what would you see as current priorities in Athens at the moment? On one side, you know, having to of course, you know, every day sort of play a game with Brussels, but I would like to focus, you know, more on, you know, just your point about this is seen as, you know, very much a domestic issue within Bulgaria, you know, pressing day-to-day concerns in Greece at the moment. What's keeping, you know, the finance ministry busy at the moment?
Well, at the moment, they're trying to find this 11.9 billion that they have to commit for fiscal consolidation for the next couple of years. I think the main worry, again, is that, again, the country has entered into a path of having to negotiate very, very detailed small measures to achieve this fiscal consolidation, to find this 11 billion. And there has been no attention to stimulating growth. Again, the agenda for growth, either domestically or from the European Union, assistance by the European Union, is pushed forward, backward until after the next installment, until after October. And I think there's a, you know, a point after which the public increase will not wait.
But how many scenarios do you think the ministry you know, draws up, and, you know, is, you know, what does a day look like from 9 to 5 in Athens, if it's 10 to 6, or if it's, you know, 7 to 4 in the afternoon, you know, whatever it may be? Is it, you know, a series of high flying consultants also brought in, or is this really a case we don't have the money to pay the likes of McKinsey's and BCG to be doing this for us? This is hard-nosed bureaucrats who are really trying to figure out where to find this number from.
I think they don't have the time, but also they don't have the money, but also they don't have the time. Basically, what I think they do is that they have all the accounts in front of them and try to figure out how to save, you know, a few euros here and a few euros there. And in between, they have meetings, either direct meetings or by proxy with different interest groups that push for, you know, don't cut my salary, cut somebody else's salary. And I think it's a continuous exercise of trying to balance political pressure from different groups and try to find the money. The loser always in this situation is the people who don't have voice. often it is the low-income people, the unemployed, the pensioners, and this seems to be again the case in Greece. Mm.
And if you, from the, I guess the point of view of Brussels and also Berlin as well, how much is there active involvement and also then looking and helping find those cuts as well? I mean, you know, is it quite fractious? You know, your view, you know, in Athens at the moment, you know, or you know, let's say behind the headlines, and I think the role you have to play to your electorate, you know, do you have a lot of not just bureaucrats in Brussels, but a lot of German number crunchers around?
Yes,
as well.
I think that there has been substantial assistance by Brussels and by German in particular for trying to figure out what are the numbers, but now the decisions are left for Greece. Of course, the Troika is coming in Greece in a couple of days to check these numbers and write a report that would be a recommendation to the Council to take a decision for the next installment of the loan. So at the moment, they let the Greek politicians to decide, but there's soon to be a judging on that.
Absolutely. Vasilis Masteriotis from the European Institute at the LSE. Thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. It's just 15:15 the hour here in London. We're back after this.
On the latest edition of The Menu, Monocle 24's weekly food and drink show, we speak to two top chefs. Spaniard José Pizarro, who's trying to prove to the world that there is a lot more to discover in Spanish cuisine. We also meet Andrew McLeish, the chef at Chapter One, a Michelin-starred restaurant hidden in the British countryside. We hear the latest on local coffee trends in Jerusalem, and we meet wine manufacturers of Livermore Valley in California, who are ready to challenge neighboring Napa Valley and the rest of the world with their products.
I'm looking to make something that's profound, something that's delicious, something that's age-worthy. I'm trying to make something that's going to be historically important, hopefully.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Monocle Film stepped into the kitchen to watch Chef Jonathan Conroy prepare the perfect summer meal. A traditional Turkish starter, spaghetti vongole from the Med, and a quintessential British classic, the raspberry trifle, deliciously take shape on screen.
The fresh coriander is a really important thing. You have to be heavy-handed on that. Over-generous on the coriander. It's meant to, every flavour should pack a punch.
Summer on a Plate, on film, on monocle.com.
.1817 here in Studio One at Midori House. You're listening to Midori House indeed on Monocle 24. Well, in the economic stakes, Colombia has surpassed Argentina, making it the second largest economy in South America. Well, that's what Colombia's outgoing finance minister Juan Carlos Echeverri claims. Argentina's government isn't quite so sure, arguing that Echeverri didn't use the official currency rate of the Argentine peso when he did his sums. No one can disagree that Colombia is certainly on the rise. Juan Manuel Santos's government has certainly done a good job. The economy is growing. Streets are safer and the drug cartels are on the wane. Well, for more on that, we're joined by Anastasia Maloney. I only spoke to you, it wasn't even 24 hours, Anastasia. You're on the line from Bogota. Hello.
Hello.
I guess we have to add to that what we were talking about last eve as well on the Daily, about potentially some hopeful talks with the FARC as well. So, you know, quite a positive shopping list. But how is this playing out? You know, triumphant in the pages, you know, in Bogota and rather different in Buenos Aires.
That's right. Actually, it hasn't got as much play as you'd expect because there's been other more important news in Colombia's week of important announcements about the peace talks. So I think that's overshadowed this, and I think it would have got more play if the peace talks hadn't been announced recently. But Juan Carlos Echeverri, as you said, the Colombia's outgoing finance minister, he's claiming that Colombia's now surpassed Argentina to be the second largest economy in South America and the third largest in Latin America after Brazil and Mexico. And it depends on, as you said, how you do the maths and what figures you use. He used the unofficial exchange rate, the black market exchange rate for the Argentine peso, and not the official one. And that's why some economists are saying that his figures are a bit skewed, and in fact, it's a bit of wishful thinking before he leaves his job.
What type of, you know, because he's outbound, I'm wondering what type of government support surrounds him? Because, of course, the government is going to want to look good. Or is there any sense of distancing this, or that these numbers from a Colombian perspective need to be looked at a little bit more closely?
No, there's no sense of that. From the Colombian perspective, these figures have been published with graphs and all the rest of it on the website of the Ministry of Finance.
So they must be true then.
That's right, they must be true then. But there are all sorts of graphs and tables and calculations to show how he got to these figures. And also the figure depends on whether or not you believe in the real value of the Argentine peso according to the Argentine government. To what extent are they overvaluing their own local currency is another question, and that's always open to speculation. So in his defense, that's what he would say, that in fact the Argentine economy is a bit overvalued.
What about in real terms? Wonderful that we can look at pie charts and graphs going up and down and doing all of those things which look very compelling. But as I say, you've been on the ground there for quite some time. What's the evolution that you've noticed just in terms of, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be suits arriving, from Frankfurt or from Houston or elsewhere. But if you actually just look at it, impact on the economy in terms of day-to-day life, you know, whether that's office construction, new headquarters coming in, you know, what does it look like in real terms?
I arrived in Colombia about 10 years ago, and it was a very different place when I first arrived. 10 years later, you can definitely see that Colombia has enjoyed robust economic growth over the last 5 years, you know, of about 5 to 6%. And that's been translated into greater, growing middle class of Colombians. You can see that they're spending more money. The shopping malls are packed. There seems to be a new shopping mall being constructed every week in Bogota. You can see international chains, restaurants being opening the whole time. International high street names that you'd find in Europe are now in the streets in Bogota, Zara, Mango, the Spanish retailers there coming in. And also the other foreign investors particularly are keen to explore Colombia's untapped oil and mining sectors. And you see more foreigners, more oil engineers and bankers from across the world than you ever did 10 years ago.
I guess when you're looking from let's say, a jockeying position, and looking down the continent at Argentina, does it slightly sort of smack of sour grapes if they are causing a bit of fuss and calling into question? Because, you know, I think for so long, you know, aside from sort of, you know, a basket case economy for some stretch, there was that sense that Buenos Aires, you know, was, you know, the capital of Spanish-speaking Latin America, that this was, you know, the place that had the lifestyle, had all of these things. You know, but it does seem that, of course, you know, Bogota has been making more of a name for itself. So is it a little bit like sort of the indolent child in the corner, you know, putting up their hand at this point, do you think?
A bit, but I do think, I mean, Colombia and Argentina there is a sense of rivalry between the two countries. And as you say, Argentina has always claimed the mantle of being the leader of South America in terms of culture, the economy, and just generally calling the shots. And Colombia's foreign policy, and particularly under the President Juan Manuel Santos, he really wants to raise Colombia's hand on all levels, on the economy and foreign policy and tourism. And I think this is part of that. And, you know, if they're going to publish figures that show that Colombia's surpass Argentina, they're going to do it without any apologies. And it's also part of the general rivalry with Argentina and Brazil and Mexico. There's always jostling for position, who wants to be seen as the leader of the region after Brazil.
And just before we go, how much of a gap would be created, you know, if we just reflect on what we were talking about last night, if peace talks, you know, do indeed get underway in Oslo? I mean, what type of spread does that create? And, you know, does it really, you know, at that point firmly, you know, put Colombia in the number two position, but I mean, really on ascendancy if the FARC will sit down?
I think it's going to change Colombia completely. It's a turning point in its history. I don't know if there's any exaggeration about that. This is the most important news to come out of Colombia for more than a decade, if these peace talks do actually reach a negotiated settlement and the FARC lays down their arms. It's estimated that the conflict, the money spent on the conflict, the huge military expenditure, the budget that's spent on keeping the troops and the planes and all the rest of it, is about 1 to 2% of Colombia's GDP a year. So if you take that away, the idea is that Colombian government would spend more on social issues, lifting more people out of poverty, and that the money that used to be spent on the military defense budget would then go to social issues, agriculture, education, and health.
Anastasia Maloney, our correspondent in Bogota, thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House, 24 minutes after the hour. We're back and we're off to Venice, but not for architecture. You'd be forgiven for thinking we're a little obsessed with Venice at the moment here at Monocle 24, but no sooner had the vernissage for the 13th Architecture Biennale ended than the global film industry rode into town for the 69th Film Biennale. After 7 days of screenings and Veneto spritzes, word on the canals is that there's a swell of new female directors making their mark, and we're joined for more on that by Jason Solomons, who's just fresh off his flight back from Da Vinci Airport. Welcome.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. I have an Aperol Spritz in my hand, but just for you.
Wonderful. I can only sort of muster a double espresso at the moment. I think what's always important, Jason, when people come back from these, I just want to know, what should I be looking out for, whether it's on iTunes, even though they're not very good at uploading new foreign films, it seems. But certainly if I'm going to resort to DVDs or going out to the cinema, four or five things that we need to be watching out for, in your opinion.
Yeah. Well, Venice is always the curtain raiser for the season. I mean, it comes there to extend the summer season on the Venice Lido. And it sort of acts as a sort of kickstart into the kind of proper films after the blockbusters of summer. It's the curtain raiser for what's going to form, I guess, the Oscar race to come in the next sort of 4 or 5 months, all the way around to the Globes and the BAFTAs and the Oscars. And we've definitely had a few contenders. Certainly the best actor category looks to be filling up fast. Two of them probably in the same film. Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman are outstanding together, kind of like Nadal versus Federer, raising their game, slugging it out with very different styles to each other in this film, The Master by Paul Thomas Anderson, who, I think is probably the best American director of his generation. He was there with There Will Be Blood in 2007. He's done Boogie Nights and Magnolia. And this film is based on the early days of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard. It's got a slight controversy around it, but really it's about these two guys. Joaquin Phoenix plays a desperate alcoholic drifter who's taken in by this kind of newfound religious cult led by the charismatic, dandyish Philip Seymour Hoffman. And those two really kind of, it's a kind of bromance in a way between those two, one dependent on the other in some kind of way, one for alcohol and flaws, and the other one for kind of a sort of calm and spirituality. It's kind of amazing to watch those two go at it. And they are both terrific in the film, which I think is really rather masterly. It's kind of long, but it's a definite big hit and probably the front runner for Best Picture at next year's Oscars already.
Okay, so if I'm going to step past midnight, then okay, I'm definitely going to rent or buy The Master. Number two, what would you nominate?
Well, you could go for, you mentioned that the women, the female film directors are a bit biting back. You might remember like 6 months ago or so, I was on the show kind of talking about the lack of female directors at Cannes and how the world had roundly criticized it for that. Well, Venice took the upper hand rather quickly and gave 20 female directors berths in various competition slots on the Lido. Now, some of them are terrific. Some of them are more experimental. I saw a very good one that completely surprised me by Denmark's Susanne Bier. Yeah, she's previously won the Best Foreign Picture Oscar for In Another World, but this one is a sort of Euro rom-com, a kind of Danish, do you remember The Festen, that great film by Thomas Vinterberg about the Danish family gathering? Well, put that with Mamma Mia and imagine the results. It's kind of set up a family wedding in the beautiful Amalfi coast of Sorrento, and Pierce Brosnan plays a character who comes and sort of finds love again with a cancer-stricken mother. I mean, it sounds awful, and after 5 minutes I thought I was going to go and sort of, this is why airlines invented stick bags, but actually, it is completely charming, very classily done, and really rather wonderful. I think it could be a really big surprise hit, something to really watch out for. It's called Love Is All Around, and despite that Richard Curtis-y title, it's really much better than all of that.
And it clearly sort of keeps the Danish momentum on big screen and also the smaller screen going, and interesting that it has nothing to do with people in woolly Faroese jumpers. Number three, I see your nominations here, so if you had to choose, you've got The Reluctant Fundamentalist, but you also have Bad 25, which also sounds interesting as well.
well, I loved Bad 25. I have to say it's Spike Lee culturally reassessing Michael Jackson's Bad album 25 years through the month when it was first unleashed on the world. Think back to that time, Tyler, the big hair, the blockbuster culture of the time. This was the time that was dominated by, you know, on the big screen by Arnie, Bruce Willis, Sly Stallone. And on the, and really on the pop charts, it was blockbuster time. It was Madonna, it was Prince, it was Michael Jackson. You had to have a massive tour to go with your album. You filled stadia, you did videos, it was MTV culture personified. And Bad, how do you follow up Thriller? Well, you know, Michael Jackson came up with Bad. It was the only album to have 5 successive number ones released from it. Until that is, Katy Perry did it recently, but I think the world has changed somewhat if you can compare those two. Michael Jackson's Bad, was it good? Well, yeah. If you go back to it and look at the videos that surround it and the music that surrounds it and how it was made, Spike Lee does a brilliant, polished job. He's such a good documentary maker, Spike Lee. And this is a slick, funky piece of work that really gets into... I mean, Michael Jackson was the star of Venice. You know, he's not really alive, but he just was, again, through Bad 25. And I've been moonwalking on air ever since I saw this film. I mean, I was at Wembley in 1988, which is a kind of centerpiece of this film because they've unearthed footage from it. I've never seen, you know, a centenar of that footage that I was there that night. And there it was, again, like wafting towards me on the Venice Lido. And it was just marvellous to see how good he was when he was at the top of his game.
Jason Solomons, enjoy that Veneto Spritz. Please send one around for me, even though it's only a Tuesday afternoon here in London. Coming up the next half hour of the program, we'll find out why lobsters in the eastern U.S. are perhaps in need of a bit of a marketing makeover. And we'll also find out how the Chinese government managed to hush a major media story for months.
We have to be very, very careful that the Ministry of Propaganda and the news people there and the Communist Party are not playing us in the sense of giving us selected pieces of information that we can't then externally and independently verify.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24 är jag också.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And you are back in Studio One here at Midori House, listening to Midori House. It is just 18:32, which means we're 2 minutes late, almost 2.5 minutes late for Jonathan Wheatley with the bottom of the hour headlines.
Thanks very much. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, addressing the House of Commons here in London today, said he was deeply concerned about Iran's nuclear programme, saying it would make the Middle East far more unstable. The President of the Red Cross, Peter Moore, is looking at ways of expanding humanitarian operations in Syria as he held talks today with President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, the German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle at an international conference on Syria in Berlin has said today that Germany does not rule out accepting Syrian refugees for medical treatment and assistance. Democrats are preparing to launch their case for President Barack Obama's re-election at their national convention today in Charlotte, North Carolina. Police teams kept a lookout for rowdy protesters and possible threats to the convention. And Indonesian and Australian senior ministers have continued talks on defence issues in Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, including search and rescue operations for boat refugees seeking asylum. The Australian defence minister said that the two countries have a very good relationship. And for the moment, those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jonathan Wheatley. Well, this summer, Maine has had a record lobster catch. Good news, you might think, lobster in abundance, but the glut of delicious Atlantic crustaceans has created its own problem. Prices of the usually rarefied creatures have reached a 30-year low, and restaurateurs can't make it of bisque, thermidor, or spaghetti alla ragosta. Meanwhile, some lobstermen have given up fishing altogether. There is simply too much lobster for the market to cope with. It's not worth their while, they say. The state's answer is to launch a $3 million marketing push to persuade New Englanders to indulge in crustaceans. Well, to discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Bob Bayer, director of the Lobster Institute at the University of Maine, and in the studio by my colleague Ariane Alphen from our sister company, Wink Creative. I'm going to start with you, Mr. Bayer. I think everyone would be quite surprised that there's, in fact, a Lobster Institute. What happens at the Lobster Institute on a Tuesday?
Well, good question, Tyler. We're involved in research and education related to lobster in the U.S. and in Canada. and whatever the issues are at the moment we are involved with, whether it's product development, lobster health, could be almost anything, or the current glut of lobster.
Let's talk about the current glut, because also I can remember stories past as well about scarcity of lobster. So what has happened? No predators, has the continental shelf improved? What's the positive for the lot of lobsters at the moment?
Well, my guess, and I think this is the common guess, and that's just what it is that climate change is affecting the lobster catch. Shed of lobsters, that is when lobsters molt into legal size in Maine, started early, and it seems to have come all at once rather than in clumps where it moves from southwest to northeast, so that we don't have this huge abundance all at once. You put it all together, and you put that in addition, the catch in Canada prior to Maine lobsters coming online was also good, so that the processing facilities had a lot of what they needed, and they'd also paid a higher price at that time.
If it's interesting that you look at there's a push on from a domestic perspective, if we're to believe the numbers, a $3 million marketing push to encourage people to put lobsters on barbecues and in pots, etc. Do you think it needs to just be a domestic play? I'm wondering if in fact the money shouldn't be spent elsewhere, this side of the Atlantic or in Asia, to also perhaps create a bit of a brand around Maine lobster versus Nova Scotia lobster.
Well, I think the reason for that is when we're dealing with live lobster, the lobsters that we catch in Maine in the summer and fall are new shell lobsters that have a limited shipping capacity. You can't ship them very well. You can ship some of them, but many of them will not make the trip to Europe or Asia. Whereas as we move towards hard shell lobsters, they'll make that trip very easily. I mean, there is some shipping to Europe and Asia at this point, but not a lot. These are very fragile lobsters.
Could some argument, this is maybe not a great problem to have in the autumn of 2012, also because the barrier for entry drops and more people maybe who traditionally have not sampled lobster suddenly are able to put it on their table for the first time. It does encourage, more sampling. It allows people to develop a taste for it. Can't this also be seen as a positive?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing lobster in places that never had lobster before in terms of retail outlets and restaurants that are actually featuring lobster. Oftentimes, this is lobster in a form that has been processed, so to speak. That is, these are frozen lobster tails or picked lobster meat that is being used for these types of markets. So it's a little bit different, and that's the material that actually you could ship to Europe or Asia easily if there were demand for frozen tails or picked meat.
Great. Bob Bayrat, the director of the Lobster Institute at the University of Maine, thanks very much for that. As I was saying in the intro, my colleague Ariane Elfin is here from the branding agency Wink Creative. Are you sort of sitting there, Ariane, saying, I need to open up a franchise of Red Lobster in North London right now?
I think there's a lot of lobster franchise happening in North London. It's a shame we don't have this this production problem over here with a burger and lobster in particular opening in Soho and in Mayfair. I think here we really appreciate lobster, and there's a huge need for it, especially at a certain price. Maybe in the US they've been a little too spoiled in Maine with lobster, and it just doesn't have that cachet anymore.
I mean, it's interesting. Over the decades, we've just seen the power of caviar brands, etc. And of course, there's no shortage of companies doing smoked salmon or Gravlax, who've created great brands and can charge, they can charge the appropriate premium. Do you think there's room then for a fresh lobster brand? If I knew that these lobsters were also captured in, you know, wonderfully maintained traps, and they maybe had a better flight than the other lobsters, that I'd be happy to pay more before they went into the pot, the poor things.
I think in Europe we're definitely willing to pay more for lobster, and when we think about lobster and Aragosta and Omar, for us it's something very luxurious. I think it's probably the image of lobster in the domestic market. I think probably when on the East Coast, when you think about lobster, you have lobster shacks, you know, rolled, you know, slap a lot of mayonnaise onto lobster.
Mm.
And it needs to regain that luxury premium, you know, caviar level, aesthetic and appeal.
I mean, do you think that's hard, though, as well, when I certainly, as Mr. Bear was saying, so much of it is about freshness as well. So do you think it's difficult to then go and carve out your own little box at the fishmonger? You just have to have a leap of faith and say, OK, you know, I believe this is fresh. I believe it's, in this case, if we're trying to help the economy of Maine, then I believe this is a Maine lobster. Or do you think maybe he needs a little tattoo or something, the lobster?
He could have an authenticity tattoo made in Maine and grown in Maine, you know, in the past
happily,
month.
Happily grown in Maine.
Very happy, soft shell. And I think that, you know, if you can buy it for half the price, then it means you'd have half that money to market it and just make it look that much better. And I think that economy would work well for brand lobster.
I mean, do you think that this is just, you know, obviously, as you're saying, maybe, you know, indeed global warming has changed things, and the growing season is going to be, you know, that much more different. So you will almost need segmentation anyway at this point if there is going to be a glut of lobster going forward. Great that people can sample it now, but then probably maybe there's going to be, you know, maybe Nova Scotia lobster is going to be sort of, you know, not so great, or it's going to be competing against, you know, Maine lobster.
I think that we'll have to like educate the people about, we don't really know the differences between lobster now. And I think that's part of the process of creating that brand around lobster, is differentiating, you know, Nova Scotia from Maine, which ones are good raw, which ones are better for the lobster roll.
An Omar sommelier, maybe.
Yes. Something like that, yeah.
Erin Elfin from Wink Creative, thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. When we come back, we're going to be talking about China's latest political crisis.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service and, of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So, drop in to one of our shops, and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Bears.
You are cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, the show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, we get some cultural offerings from the Venice Architecture Biennale and test our fortunes with a unique character from the old American fairground.
It's fascinating to see school-aged children just look up and wonder what she's going to say.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. It's 1:43 in Beijing, 1843 here in London. Well, the impact from a car crash in the Chinese capital in the early hours of March 18th is being felt in the quarters of power in the Chinese capital. The story just won't go away, despite official reports to airbrush this potentially explosive drama from cyberspace and the media at large. Why all the interest? Well, it was no ordinary car, and there were no ordinary passengers. And the result? A close ally of President Hu Jintao has just been sidelined weeks ahead of the once-in-a-decade Communist Party leadership reshuffle. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Burgess Watson spoke to Paul French, the chief China strategist for Mintel and author of Midnight in Peking. He started by asking him what happened.
Well, back in March, as far as we know, there was a tragic crash on one of the ring roads in Beijing. It was a Ferrari, an extremely expensive Ferrari, $800,000 Ferrari, not that common in China, that at very high speed crashed into the side of the road, an underpass, and the driver was killed outright. Remarkably, if you look at the pictures on the internet of the car, two women that were in the car managed to walk away. This all got covered up, but of course immediately people started asking questions of, you know, in China, who exactly owns a car of that price tag? The census did sort of cover it up, but obviously rumor has carried on going around, and now the rumor is that it was the son of a man called Ling Jihua, who, as you said, was very close to the outgoing president of China, Hu Jintao, who leaves next month to be replaced by Xi Jinping. And this, of course, all coming at the same time as the whole Wang Lijun, the chief of police in the city of Chongqing, went to the American consulate in the city of Kunming and revealed and blew wide open the whole story of the Bo Xilai crisis and his wife Gu Kailai and the alleged murder now that she's been convicted of the British businessman Neil Hayward. All of this has come along at the same time, and the speculation is that this is some extremely devious house cleaning prior to the changeover in government in China.
And one of the results of that house cleaning and the airbrushing of this story has been that, you know, 500 million internet users in China, when they searched Ferrari online, were met with a no result to their query. So not for the first time this year, Beijing taking no chances, it would seem, with a possible scandal and doing everything they can to snuff it out. Should they be worried?
You know, yes and no, they're trying to snuff it out. I mean, you know, I think something else might be going on here, which is the Chinese government. Obviously, we sometimes assume that the Chinese government kind of blunders when it comes to manipulating the media, because when they do it abroad, it often comes across very badly and very clumsily around issues like particularly Tibet and the Dalai Lama and so on. But within China, particularly when it's these matters of party, inter-party maneuverings and so on, or intra-party maneuverings, there's only one party, they can be very sophisticated in what they're doing. And I think what's going on here is that if you look at what happened with the Bo Xilai scandal, the way that, you know, he was really taken down was that the story came out that the elite of China, the Communist Party hierarchy, had been enriching itself, and the children, the Red Princes and the Red Princesses of that elite, had been enriching themselves to quite astonishing levels. The Bo Xilai case, at the end of the day, comes down to a large amount of property and a large amount of cash. This story here is also about the son, a Red Prince, of a member of the elite being in trouble. Now, this is something that goes on all the time in China and has done since before 1989 and was a big issue back in 89 as well, the question of the elite enriching themselves. Now, the problem is many of them, or all of them, may well be enriching themselves. Which stories we get to hear about seem to be about the people that they want to bring down. We know that there are lots of other stories, that some of which are known in China quite widely, some of which aren't, about other members of the party elite right up to the top. And those stories don't get out. So it is one of those things that there's almost like a big filing cabinet somewhere with all of these stories in it. And when you want to go after someone, you can pull out the relevant file.
So lots of questions, and you've raised so many of them already. And one of them you raised right at the beginning about this $800,000 Ferrari 458 Spider, for a gift to a 23-year-old boy, a very generous gift. But it does reveal, doesn't it, and you've touched on this, a massively widening wealth gap. But on top of that, this hypocrisy on the part of the officials who claim to be communists.
Yeah, I mean, there is obviously a widening wealth gap in China. And I don't think anyone in China, quite honestly, is that worried about a guy who set up a factory making cigarette lighters who now makes all the iPods, becoming extremely rich, buying a Ferrari and sending his son abroad to university. No one begrudges that. It's a very egalitarian society in that way. What we're looking at is almost a sort of communist monarchy, a communist aristocracy that has emerged, where the sons and daughters feel an extreme sense of entitlement due to their father's political positions. And, of course, because the Communist Party controls pretty much every facet of Chinese life, you know, prying into what they're up to is very difficult. So the question of, you know, why public servants, effectively, are able to, you know, buy their children cars of this magnitude or send them abroad to extremely expensive universities or private schools, when a lot of Chinese people would like to do that and struggle very hard to find the cash to do that in order to better their lives, that there is this rich elite that almost sort of, in the way of the sort of French aristocracy before the revolution, has sort of lost touch with reality and sort of just assumes that this is their right now. And I think that, that is something that the party is very aware that people are not happy about and may get very angry about, but also it's something that it can use when it needs to destroy someone's reputation for one reason or another.
And do you think the president, Hu Jintao, has been somewhat kept in the dark regarding the activities of those around him and their offspring? Because it certainly sounds as though if the action's been taken 5 months after the event and this man has been demoted only now, that perhaps he wasn't to speed with this particular story at the outset.
No, I don't believe that at all. I don't believe you come to be the head of the Chinese Communist Party and the head of the whole of China without being quite aware of a lot of what's going on, particularly in an organization as secretive and as prone to internal wheeler dealing as the Chinese Communist Party. Look, Hu Jintao is on his way out, and like everyone when they leave, Jiang Zemin before him, Deng Xiaoping before him, they're very concerned about legacy protection. He will want to go and he will want the history to show that he was a good leader who advanced China towards its peaceful rise and its rightful place in the global economy and so on. Other people will be wanting to stay around. They won't all want to go with him. A new administration is coming in and there needs to be a clean sweep of the broom through Zhongnanhai, the leadership compound in Beijing. And some people will have been involved in things that, the new administration doesn't want to be tarred with. They will be people who represent different factions. There will be old fights there. Don't forget, we all talked about during the Bo Xilai incident in Chongqing, the amount of the clannish nature, the regional nature, the factions within the party that were really battling each other there as well. It's not strictly a political debate. It's regional, it's family-based, it's clan-based, it's based on all sorts of interests. Someone in the new administration, it would seem, has an interest in making sure that Ling Jihua doesn't survive Hu Jintao, and they seem to have achieved that, and the way they've done it is to go at the sun.
And that was Tom Burgess Watson talking to the chief China strategist from Intel, Paul French. Not a very good week or even a good last 48 hours for Ferrari, with, of course, another high-profile crash as well in Bangkok that killed a police officer. Bangkok Post newspaper leading with a story about, it says, Red Bull Air admits hit and run, killed a police officer. Also a black Ferrari involved in that story. You are listening to Midori House. In a moment, we're off to Naples. Well, it is 19:52 in Naples. And that means it's time to go and talk to our editor, Andrew Tuck, who's on the road this week. He's at the sixth session of the World Urban Forum, which is in the southern Italian capital. Hello, Mr. Tuck.
Hello there. And hello from a terrace where there's about to be a thunderstorm. So if you hear a loud clap, it's not cheering people. It's actually thunder.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you arrived safe and sound. One of our earlier guests had a Veneto spritz in hand. Do you have a Veneto spritz as well?
There's a bottle of wine coming our way, apparently.
Oh.
But I thought I'd hold off until I'd done the check-in. That seemed unwise to start on the wine before I'd spoken to you.
To start by telling us that, there are a plethora of urban forums, and it seems that almost every country and city wants to position themselves as a great thinking center for how to improve city life. Is that the same pitch for the World Urban Forum as well?
Yeah, it's got a very kind of general title. It's about the future of the city. And it's a slightly unwieldy beast. There's hundreds and hundreds of delegates here from all over the world. And we sat in on a session yesterday, which was a round table, which must have had actually sitting at the table some 150 people. Each was allowed to speak for like 2 minutes. It was like speed conferencing. And so from that, you had an impression of how unwieldy this is. It's a beast of a meeting.
Mm. And do you think that's because there are so many vested interests in terms of potential sponsors and regions that were promised their 90 seconds around the mic, or is that a sloppy organization?
I think it's just the number of people that the UN represents, and everybody wants to be, if they've paid their money to UN Habitat, they want to turn up, they want to send several mayors. They've tried to restrict the number of delegates from each organization attending each event. But even so, at any one time there's maybe like 10 meetings going on, and they're busy, and they're full of very conflicting interests. So it's just very hard to get a coherent message out of what's going on here.
Mm. Well, of course, when we heard from Hugo over the past few days when he was at the Venice Biennale, or came back to base at the end of last week, there was much talk that there was this theme in Venice about common ground, and that's what all of the architects and the pavilions seemingly work towards. Is there a central theme for this conference as well?
Well, what's interesting is it's not actually all about technology, which is a lot about what the other urbanism events seem to be about at the moment. I think that
you mean you haven't you haven't downloaded the app yet.
I haven't downloaded the app yet. I haven't been forced to do anything like that. But what's interesting, I guess, is that lots of the people here are kind of involved with quite grassroots things. So even when you meet representatives from things like the Jan Gehl Institute in Copenhagen, it's from their part of their organization that actually deals with looking at developing cities. Lots of the representatives here are from cities which are growing at an incredible pace, and they're trying to share some information about how to kind of cope with that.
Mm. So, if I'm a delegate and I'm from a capital on the rise or an urban center on the rise in Latin America, am I there to talk to people in the private sector, Andrew, and maybe hopefully find some solutions or some consultants to work on my traffic problems, or how do I deal with an emerging middle class, how I'm going to house them? Or is it perhaps more talking to people from the public sector and finding benchmarks, what have they done well in Palermo, or was there an inspired concept in Tel Aviv?
I think it's more in the public sector. There's very few official sponsors here from the big corporate side. There's a really kind of tiny stand for Coca-Cola. I think that's about as much as I've seen on the corporate side. There's no kind of car companies involved. There's no big tech companies involved. The people here are really kind of other NGOs, other institutions, other city governments. And there's some really high representatives who are definitely trying to change the way that this conference is run and make it a little bit more effective. And we've met with some amazing people. But I think that the problem is that the UN tries to work on consensus. And actually, when you look around, people are trying to present very different images of what the city should be.
Mm.
The Tehran has a huge stand here, although oddly the mayor of Tehran, who was meant to host a big event today, has kind of disappeared already. But you're sitting there looking at Tehran's image of what a modern city should be, while you're also meeting, say, Marcelo Ebrard, who's the mayor of Mexico City. We've chatted with him, and he's trying to present the image that cities must be liberal, must kind of move with their people, must be open to attract investment. And suddenly you think, actually, at one point there was the mayor of Tehran and the mayor of Mexico City sitting next to each other, and their vision of what should happen in an urban environment is so diametrically opposed to each other.
And does that then cause not confusion? I'm sure that all delegates can kind of make up their own mind, but does it also sort of leave people with the idea that you need strong leadership? And I don't want to come back to a Bloomberg example. Of course, he is he was democratically elected. He has extended his term, but nevertheless, here you have a CEO of the city, and I'm wondering if that is something which is emerging. It's wonderful having great politicians, but cities are about business. They're about looking over the horizon. It's about the ebb and flow of commerce, and is there a sense there that, especially as it's the UN, that maybe cities just need better leadership?
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's why some of Marcelo Ebrard, he was certainly kind of surrounded by people after he finished speaking. People really wanted to engage with him. And then I think there's also some people from high up in government who have turned up trying to kind of change the debate. So we caught up with people from the US Trade Department who were also kind of keen to see what they could do to kind of change the business environment of cities. And that was good, actually. There was a very good conversation about why it's the mom-and-pop stores, it's like the individual traders who are as important to the future of any city as big companies. And they were saying that's because, actually when times get tough, it's the people who are the individual traders who've got nowhere to go, so they stay invested in the community. They help turn around a city, whereas actually big business when it gets tough. They think, actually, we could move our operation to another city or to another country.
Andrew Tuck in Naples. We're going to have to leave it there. That's all the time we have for today. Today's program is produced by Hannah Jenkins. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch. The Monocle Daily is here at 2200 this evening. The lovely Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson, they're going to be driving the program. Nancy Durham is back tomorrow with Midori House. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye.